Joining me in the KRVS studios this afternoon, I'm very happy to say, is Sadie Hoagland. She is an assistant professor in the English department here at UL Lafayette. She's also the director of creative writing here at the university. That program is an enormous program here at the university. I know each year there's a little bit of how many PhDs did so-and-so graduate? But the creative writing concentration in the English department generally per year graduates the most PhDs at the university, and your PhDs get jobs all over the country. So it's a pretty fabulous program. It is a concentration in creative writing. Of course, the PhD is in English, but you have concentrations in folklore, creative writing, rhetoric, and
literature.
Okay. So it is, again, an amazing program. You have just had your first book of short stories published. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And you'll have a novel coming out in about a year as well. So you've been very busy, in addition to all of the work you do as a teacher and, of course, directing creative writing. The title of your book is American Grief in Four Stages. People will have the opportunity to hear you read this Saturday, November 2nd, at Achilles Print Studio, which is in the Oil Center. It's at 912 Coolidge Street.
Yes.
So that's an open reading, and everybody can attend if they would like. Well, let's talk a bit about you first. I know we have a lot of writers in this area. People love stories, and people write at all different levels. But there are a lot of people who admire writers, but to them, it's kind of a mysterious process. Mm-hmm. You know, how do you know you're a writer? Why do you do it? Why does one keep on writing? You know, it's a lot of questions about that, and it seems like a field that people aren't always sure, you know, what does one do in that field? So tell us just a bit about your background. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Salt Lake City, Utah, and I always wrote. I was always journaling from the time I was very young on. I remember writing a book about a kidnapping of a dog at maybe 8. I wrote it on sort of funny notepaper that had pictures of monkeys on it. So I was always writing and always thought of it as a hobby and not a professional opportunity. And that continued through college. I was a psychology major in college. I took every creative writing class I had a chance to. I sort of probably could have minored in English with all the literature classes I took. But I'd always had a narrative in my mind that, you know, writing was something that you do on the side. It's not a professional career. You can't really make money, which may have been accurate.
Were those stories you told yourself, or did other people tell you those things?
I think a little both. It was sort of the beginning of the STEM movement in schools and the heavy push towards that. And so towards the end of college, after lots of encouragement from my creative writing professors, I began to think maybe this is something I could truly pursue. So I came back to Salt Lake City and I started interning at a magazine and staff writing for another magazine, just sort of local magazines, and trying to do some freelance writing, and found that I really enjoyed it, and really enjoyed it as a possible career because of all the different questions you could constantly explore. I mean, writing in some ways is many careers because you're doing one thing, but you're exploring all kinds of different subjects, learning about different things for every book, for every project. And so it became more and more interesting to me, and I decided to pursue graduate study and, you know, became a professor, an assistant professor here after doing a master's and a PhD elsewhere in California and then in Utah. And now I sort of balance teaching and writing, which is a professionally viable career. And it's been working out really well.
Well, I remember hearing glowing things about your writing when you were first hired here. And so even then, people were recognizing just the passion you felt for this career, as you said, as really many careers. And I think some people, you know, obviously there are some people publishing novels who make a career out of that. But there are many writers who do teach as well. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be an integral part of your work. Is that something that you have found to be satisfying as well, in addition to the writing?
Yes, I think it works both ways. And in one sense, I'm not an introvert. And so sitting alone in a room all day writing isn't something that I think is sustainable for my personality. And so having the sort of external world to talk with about writing, to speak with my students and my colleagues, is sort of a perfect balance. And also to be in a job that recognizes writing as my research and that supports me and gives me time and summers, et cetera, to actually do that work is really important. But I also learn a lot from my students. I also teach creative writing pedagogy, so I get to think a lot about how we teach creative writing, the conversations we have around writing. And I think that my students are always bringing in different ideas in terms of both their writing and their teaching. And it's always sort of making me question what I'm doing back in my own writing. Sometimes I'm directly inspired by sort of their work ethic. I'll be like, wow, so-and-so has decided they're going to write a novel in 1 month. I better.
Maybe their professor better do that too.
At least I could sit down and write this morning. So I think it's inspiring in lots of ways.
Well, and I ask that too, because you just recently published an essay on how to write about grief.
Yes.
And there's a lot of really fascinating information, and made me think about how you even think about your own stories and your own life. You know, because there is an element of you are more in control when you do write your own stories internally. You know, I mean, that gets into a whole self-help issue. But that was fascinating to read the essay, and I could see that it was very important to you to think about that, not only for yourself, but for your students as well. That was a great essay.
Thank you.
So how did your own style come about? You've mentioned a number of things, what you wrote about at 8, and that you were in psychology, and that you did some journalism. How did your style come about? What were you drawn to ultimately as a writer? What to write about, how to write, where did that develop?
I think for everything I write, the development is slightly different and the trajectory is slightly different. And I'm not sure that that's true of every writer, but for me, it certainly is. So for example, the novel that's coming out in 2021 is about a polygamist community. And that has roots in my childhood growing up in Utah, thinking about polygamy, reading about polygamy in the news. There was a little polygamist family in a friend's neighborhood, and we used to bike over there and sort of spectate them. And so that sort of is something I've been thinking about my entire life and took years of research to write and to think about. With this short story collection, it's varied even within itself. So it varies from the novel, but it also varies within itself. So some of the stories really came about by starting with one line. So, for example, in the title story, the first line is, "We knew my sister was really different after all, the day she was murdered." And that line just sort of popped into my head, and it's obviously an evocative line, but it sort of acted like a bait, you know, on a line, and it sort of towed me along as I kept thinking about what kinds of framework can make a line like that work. Mm-hmm. And I was also, I think, interested at the time for several reasons in the way that language fails in the face of trauma, which is a line of Lee Gilmore's, who writes critically about trauma and testimony. And the way that when someone is grieving and someone close to us whom we love dearly, we have almost nothing to say to them outside of cliche. I mean, we have, "I'm sorry," or "my deepest sympathies." But all of those feel incredibly inadequate when you're watching a loved one suffer. And so that was something that was on my mind a lot in the last 10 years or so. And so when I came across that, you know, kind of that line popped into my head about the sister being murdered, I thought, you know, one of the things that pairs is sort of the inadequacy of language and all of the ways that our culture polices grief and police's language surrounding grief, and the way that line and ultimately some of these stories sort of defy that policing and try to get into a space that, frankly, we don't get into much into conversations about grief in our culture.
Well, and you're talking about American culture, and again, I want to remind people, my guest Sadie Hoagland's book of short stories was just published, American Grief in 4 Stages. And that story is sort of buried in the middle, even though that line really mm-hmm. started off this whole series about the sister being murdered. It's not the first story. It comes much later. And I don't know what I expected when I went into a book about grief, maybe something more the same, that each story would have a certain feeling, but you are thrown all over the place with different kinds of grief and trauma and situations and characters. And when you're talking about our culture not having the language, not having the means to help, there's a kind of a claustrophobic feeling that you have throughout the stories, where you want something to break through. You want somebody to say the right thing, and no one ever quite says the right thing in these stories. How long a period did these stories get written? 10 years, is that what you said, or what?
Nine or ten years.
Were you conscious after a certain point of wanting these stories to hang together, or what, how did that happen when, as you were writing these individual stories? Because that's as much an art, mm-hmm. putting stories together, yes. as it is writing the individual stories.
Yes, I think so. I think what happened was after I had written about four of them, that so sort of probably for the four of the kind of heavy hitters, I would call them in the book, that really directly address this problem of grief and language. I thought to myself, well, I've explored that side of grief, and I could never ask someone to read 12 stories like that. Four is plenty. How can I expand this idea and think about different angles that get at different kinds of loss and different definitions of America? So there's a couple of stories that take place in, you know, Salem witch trials or in the Aztec period. Right. Those are the only two sort of really ahistorical periods. But I do think it was important for me to think about varying not just the kind of content, subject matter, and style, but also the reaction that the reader would have. It's a big ask to ask a reader to engage with really difficult material, and I wanted there to be, if not a saving grace, at least a breath of air for the reader in certain stories. So there is humor in the book.
Little sherbet courses.
Yes, exactly. There is some humor, and I hope some lightheartedness. And that was important to me because one of the things that I think is true about grief, and I really think of my job as a writer is to get at these emotional truths. And one of the things that I think is very true about grief is it's not just one sort of feeling, and it's not all negative, which sounds odd, but there is some ambivalence in grief. There is some feelings of at times relief, depending on if the person was suffering. There can be moments of joy as you remember the person and the joy they brought you in their life. And so all of those emotions can be difficult to deal with when sort of the cultural narrative is grief is hard and sad and it's private and it's quick. So how do we sort of, you know, complicate that with narrative, I think, is something that I was thinking about in writing this collection.
Well, you mentioned four of the heavy hitters. Can we talk about some of those?
Yes.
Would you like to mention the names of those stories and just give us a sketch about them?
Sure. So the title story, American Grief in Four Stages, and Warning Signs, are two stories that I think of as sibling stories. They both deal with, and they're not only sister stories, but they deal with siblings in their pieces, the death of siblings. And in both of those cases, the narrators are quite young and dealing with not only the fact that they've lost control over their lives, but the adults in their lives who are supposed to have control don't have control either. And so they're trying to find narratives that offer a logic to a problem that defies logic. So one is a suicide and one is a murder, neither of which make any sense. And so they're desperately attempting to find a narrative that would help them move on, and trying all kinds of different, the narrator of Warning Signs is trying to kind of structure her grief through theories. And the narrator of American Grief in Four Stages is trying to break down the healing process in this sort of really materialistic way. Like, this life is her things and this life is her memories. And if we could just get rid of this, we would feel better. And of course, it's a logic that doesn't make sense and very obviously doesn't make sense to the reader. But it's also not that different than the kinds of attempts that we make in real life to help us ourselves heal. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily an illegitimate process because there is no legitimate process.
Well, and as you said, the culture too, our culture is one of solving things.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if it's a puzzle, solve it. You
yes.
know, there's got to be an answer. It's got to be a way. It's got to be mm-hmm. a way through, you know, and you should be able to do it. There's this sense of, as you said, it's so very private. We think people should be able to do that mm-hmm. themselves. And then I'm assuming one of the heavy hitters too is the one about the veteran.
Yes, that was an extra patriotic. Mm-hmm. And that story, in a lot of ways, was the most challenging piece to write. I think PTSD is a topic that's kind of hot in the news right now. And the story for me, I wanted to write it in a way that thought about ways in which we have sort of cultural kind of news stories about trauma and what's happening and what's acceptable and why things are happening. And then other situations that don't get that kind of conversation. And so one of the characters in that story is a veteran who's dealing very actively with PTSD. And another character in the story is a young woman who's lost her parents to a murder suicide. So obviously one of the darkest, if not the darkest, subjects of stories in the piece and in the collection. And I think in writing that story, I wanted to think about the ways in which we expect, and this maybe gets at the title too, that we expect a certain level of healing from people. And we put that expectation on people. We don't give them necessarily a path to that healing. But in the kind of traditional five stages of grief, the fifth stage, which my collection is sort of arguing is ultimately very difficult to get to, is acceptance. And there are some cases of the violence of war and this incredibly violent act that happens to one character's parents that are really maybe not something one can ever accept.
But the story also struck me as almost the impossibility of understanding the other, the other's grief, that you may be moving along, the other is not moving along. And sometimes when you do reach that acceptance place, you've solved the puzzle, maybe. You're going on and no longer try to enter into the other person's grief. That felt like there was that was sort of tragedy in itself, that story.
Yeah. So I think one of the difficulties that those characters find themselves is that their griefs are almost competing. And when one finds a way possibly to move on in a different pace than the other, so the other hasn't found it yet, there becomes like a very sort of an abyss between them. And one of the things that happens formally at that moment is that her narrative stays in past tense and his starts to move into the present tense. Yeah. So I think that's an astute observation that is going on with that story.
There was some amazing things happening within that story. If you're just tuning in and finding yourself very interested by what you're hearing, my guest is Sadie Hoagland. She is an assistant professor in the English department here at UL Lafayette. She is also director of creative writing. Her book of short stories, American Grief in Four Stages, has just been published. She will give a reading this Saturday, November 2nd, at Achilles Print Studio, 912 Coolidge Street in the Oil Center. And that will be at 7 o'clock on Saturday. All are invited to attend if you would like to hear her read. There will also be copies of your book there, I assume, too.
Yes.
So what's the fourth one? What is the fourth heavy story?
Frog Prince.
That was a really hard story to read. That was incredibly sad. What were you thinking as you created this story, and how did you want us to feel about grief through that one?
So that story actually started because a colleague of mine, after a reading I gave of the title story, said to me, "Oh, you're writing ghost stories." And I thought, I am? Oh, I guess I better write a ghost story. So that story includes a ghost and starts with a ghost. And actually did not start out with the framework of the Frog Prince story at all. It started very differently. And I think that's kind of something interesting that happened in the writing process there, is that I had this idea and these characters, but I needed to give them, I needed to give the reader a way in. So the Frog Prince fairy tale became that way in. So it's about two best friends who've been best friends, a boy and a girl, since they were children. And the boy is a closeted gay man and really struggling with that and struggling with drug addiction, and they're teenagers and they sort of don't have anywhere to go with these really difficult subject matters that they're dealing with. And the story is narrated from the friend's perspective after the young man has died of an overdose. And she is kind of telling the story of their friendship in flashbacks of things that happened to them, of ways in which they tried to sort of escape their own bodies and escape their own identities at certain times, the things that had happened to them, and the ways in which their experiences, as similar as they were again sort of not able to breach that abyss that you kind of mentioned with mm-hmm. extra patriotic in mm-hmm. terms of the impossibility of really being able to help the other, of being able to understand the other as mm-hmm. well. And so the Frog Prince narrative in that becomes this kind of inability to transform, and that inability to transform is, and inability to accept yourself for who you are mm-hmm. becomes ultimately unsustainable.
Right. And it also struck me in several of these stories, it's not just inability to communicate just between people in general, but between generations, that inability to communicate and fully understand and see between parents and children is very strong in a lot of these stories. Not always. There are a few parents who are able to reach out to their children, but many of them seem just completely absorbed in their materialistic life, and again, kind of coming back to this American grief, mm-hmm. that there is something definitely of the culture, that they are absorbed in their partying or the material things in their lives, or just how it's supposed to be, that, you know, you're supposed to be self-reliant and you're supposed to figure it out. And these inability to cross those abysses between parents and children. Was that a part of your thinking in a lot of these stories?
You know, I think that almost kind of arrived unconsciously. Uh-huh, uh-huh, and I uh-huh. think one of the things that I think is very true about a lot of these stories is they're about teenagers dealing with incredibly difficult things. And I think this is true of American life. It certainly was for me, that teenagers deal with really, really adult subject matter all the time. And they oftentimes don't feel as if they can talk to adults about it. And some of the things that kids have to deal with in terms of their friends' struggles with depression or sexual assault and things that they deal with privately and in their own sort of teenage group ways, I think is something that as adults we sort of forget and we're not completely aware of. And I think it adds yet another divide in the collection, that one of the things that is true about a lot of these stories is they take place in American suburbia. And there is that sort of feeling of the parents are on one side and the kids are on the other. And I think that's important to the sort of aesthetic of the collection and the mm-hmm. feel of the settings that go in between, that that there's generational divides too about how to deal with things emotionally, that, you know, some generations have been much more, oh, you got to buck up and move on. And other generations are more interested in talking about feelings. Mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. I do think that reactions to grief actually vary not only culturally, and I should say America is a very multicultural place. So I'm talking about American grief in terms of a very sort of white middle-class suburbia that I grew up in, but also vary between generations as mm-hmm. well.
Well, I'm very much a part of, I guess, the accepted culture. You know, there is a physical culture in the suburbs, but what you read about, you know, all the way back to Emerson and, you know, there's mm-hmm. American philosophers that shape mm-hmm. so much of our culture.
Yes.
But it's remarkable how you work on those voices when you're talking about how difficult it is for adults and teenagers, you know, to remember how it was to be a teenager, to speak like a teenager, or for teenagers to try and express themselves. It is remarkable how nimble you are with the different voices and the different ways teenagers try to express both to themselves and to others as well. It was really interesting. It was very exhilarating, actually, reading it, you know, in addition to just the feelings you had about the grief and the trauma and the tragedy, just to see how good you were at these different voices.
That was lovely
to see.
It may mean that I'm still a teenager at heart.
Or that you kept all of those great journals around.
Yeah, exactly.
Or that you listen to your students and that you're inspired by them as well. Again, if you are just tuning in, my guest is Professor Sadie Hoagland. She is Director of Creative Writing here at UL Lafayette. She's an assistant professor in the department. Her book, American Grief in Four Stages, a collection of short stories, has just been published. She will have a reading this Saturday, November 2nd. It will be 7 o'clock at Achilles Print Studio, 912 Coolidge Street. It's really easy to find. It goes right through the middle of the Oil Center. So really wonderful. We have so many talented writers on this campus, musicians. You know, when you think of professors, you just think somebody just teaching, but so many of you are professional creators and you create in your own field. And I'm just always a marvel at that. And this is a lovely example of the professionalism and talent that we have here on this campus. So I hope a lot of people will take that opportunity to hear you read. I think if they would like to find out more about you and your books, you have a website?
Yes, www.sadiehoagland.com. Mm-hmm. And I'm also on Facebook, so you can find me there as well.
Find out more. And your novel will be coming out in 2021?
In spring of 2021. It's called Strange Children.
All right. Well, we're going to congratulate you in advance. You know, I'm sure some people are going, well, that's far, not in the world of publishing, it isn't.
No, it's
and that's very exciting. Yes. And so close, really, this one coming out now and your novel coming out in a year. That's wonderful. So congratulations on that and really shows the quality of our professors here at UL Lafayette. Well, Sadie, thanks for coming by, taking a moment out of your very busy schedule, especially this week, to let us know more about your book, American Grief, in 4 Stages. The reading is this Saturday, 7 o'clock in the Oil Center. You can find out more through your Facebook page or through your website.
Thank you, Thank Judith. You. It's been lovely to talk.
You are listening to KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.
Le passeport pour le jazz moderne avec Djalma Garnier. Le meilleur jazz de l'Europe, l'Angleterre, les États-Unis, France et... bien sûr, Louisiane. Le passeport pour le jazz moderne avec Djalma Garnier. Ici, sur 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lac Charles.
That's Passport to Modern Jazz, Tuesday nights at 10, right here on KRVS.